well, we'd like to welcome you all to this exceptional club seminar and annual lecture. And of course, special thanks to Stuart Eldon, who made it all the way to Durham by train this morning. It's quite a long way, I know. Stuart was employed already before at Warwick, and it's funny that we spoke about it briefly already. There's exactly 10 years almost to the day that he has left Warwick. Since then, he has moved to Durham University, Geography Department. Stuart has received his PhD and his bachelor's degree at Brunel, London, PhD in 1999, I think. He took after his employment at Warwick, he took a position in political geography in 2002, I think it was. And he was awarded already his professorship in 2007, which of course, as we all know, very, very fast. At Durham, he teaches political geography and territory and geopolitics. Is that correct? And as Nick already pointed out, his work is characterized by interdisciplinarity. I think Stuart is somewhere located between history, politics, geography, and even literature, you would say, given the title of his lecture. And this, the notion of history is, of course, very obvious in his work, given also his emphasis on thinkers such as Foucault, Heidegger, and of course, because his notion of space, Henri Lefebvre. But Stuart has also written extensively and prolifically on writers such as Kant, Leibniz, and more contemporary figures such as Peter Sloterdijk, Eugène Fink, Quintin Meyersault, and many others, really. He's published four authored books, with at least two more immediately forthcoming, seven edited volumes, and countless of articles and book sections. He has also a blog, which I would strongly recommend you to visit yourself, at progressivegeographies.com, which is daily updated with notions of territory, space, and place. And the presentation today should provide a brief insight into his upcoming work and books and publications, in which Stuart will try to blend his personal interest in the classical literature with his recent interest in political geography. And having said that, I would like to give the floor to Stuart himself, who will now present on Shakespearean territories.
Thank you. It is nice to be back. It is 10 years and 2 days. Since I was last employed by Warwick. And I'm very grateful to Nick and to Maren for the introduction, but also for the invitation to come and talk to you today. Pretty much in the last 10 years, actually, really since I left here, I've been working on the question of territory in different ways. And putting it into sort of three broad areas, a whole set of political questions about territory and the kind of contemporary moment of thinking about territory in terms of territory and globalisation, the European Union, and particularly in the war on terror, which I'll say a little bit more about in a moment. Conceptual work on territory, trying to think about what territory means as an idea, a theory of territory, something that I think has been neglected within political theory, but also I think within political geography, and I'll say quite a bit more about that in the opening part of the talk. And then historical, which has been the large project I've been working on and off for the last 10 years, but really concentrating on for the last 4 years, which is a forthcoming book tracing the emergence of the concept of territory in Western political thought. And the problem that seemed to me to be, and this is something when I started reading political geography seriously, was, well, there must be a theory of territory in political geography, because there certainly isn't one, it seemed to me, within political theory. And yet I found that there were really two ways that territory was quite quickly and relatively unproblematically understood, and then people went on to look at particular territorial disputes, particular territorial arrangements, particular territorial struggles and so on. And the first way that territory seems to be understood is that territory is an outcome of territoriality, and that because there is a literature on territoriality, therefore we already have a literature that explains the question of territory. And so Robert Sack's book is a classic example of this, from 1986, looking at the notion of human territoriality, basically how humans, like animals, comport themselves to the spaces and the places, the environment that they find themselves in, to do with strategies of control, to do with strategies of marking, of bordering, of excluding, including, and so on, that you can think about humans in this kind of way, and that this understands the way that we understand territory, because territory are the particular kind of places that are produced through these territoriality strategies. That seems to be one way that territory is understood. The second one is that territory is a relatively straightforward concept. Territory is simply a bounded space under the control of a group of people or some kind of political unit. Anthony Giddens' famous phrase that the state is a bordered power container. And that people think that that's a relatively straightforward thing, and then you can go on and look at particular instances of how territories have been understood, contested, the histories of particular territories and so on. So you can look at the border between Finland and Russia in Anssi Paasi's famous work, or you can look at the emergence of the territory of Thailand, or you can look at the emergence of the boundary between France and Spain and the Pyrenees, to pick three good historical examples of how territories have been constituted. But it seems to me in a lot of that work, it doesn't actually really dig into the question of territory itself as a concept with a history and with debates about that concept. A much more useful book to me is a book by a French writer, Paul Alliez, as was originally a thesis supervised by the Marxist Nikos Palantzas. And one of the claims that Alliez makes in that book, a book that would translate the title as The Invention of Territory, is that territory always seems linked to possible definitions of the state. It gives it a physical basis which seems to render it inevitable and eternal. And it's partly to try and contest that idea that the state as a political actor is always something that's inevitable and eternal, that territory is the way that we have always organised the spaces of the world. Not simply that borders have moved between different places, but there have been different ways of ordering the world that mean that territory is actually an emergent concept rather than an ahistorical concept. So this kind of was an inspiration to how I started to try and think about this. To do what I call a kind of conceptual history of territory, or you might call a kind of genealogy in a Foucauldian sense. And really two kind of questions that motivated the work that I tried to do on this question. One of which was inspired by the philosopher Edward Casey, who wrote a really terrific book on the philosophical history of place. And what Casey does there is to say, what I'm going to try and do, and this is through the whole sweep of Western philosophical thought, is to try to think about how place and space interrelate as concepts. So one of the inspiring questions for me in the historical work was, how does territory relate to the question of space? And if space has a history, space in its practice, but also as a concept has a history, as Henri Lefebvre, for example, argues in The Production of Space, how does this influence how we think about a particular form of political space, i.e. the question of territory? And the second one was a much more politicised way of thinking about that. This is from John Gottman's work. John Gottman wrote a book called The Significance of Territory, which, for my money, is still probably the best book written on the question of territory. But in an earlier work of political geography, Gottman says that we can't seem to conceive of a state, a political institution, without its spatial definition, its territory. So if we take that question of space, how does that relate to the emergence of the question of the state? And given that there's a large literature tracing the emergence of the state as a political institution, how would that story change, or how would we rethink that story if we thought about the spatial aspect of it? Thought about the history of the state from the perspective of its territory, the spaces that it lays claim to and controls. So I've done some sort of theoretical work, sort of a political theory of territory, trying to think through this in that sort of sense, trying to suggest that actually a lot of the time when people talk about territory, they're actually collapsing it back into other notions that seem to me to be important, indeed essential to understanding territory, but seem to me to be insufficient to understand territory. And one of them is land. It's a kind of relation of property, a political economic set of questions, thinking about ownership, distribution, possibly contestation of it. But it's to think about this in a political economic register seems to me to be absolutely crucial to the question of territory, but not sufficient to understand and explain the question of territory. The second one is what I've called as a shorthand the notion of terrain, thinking about a kind of political strategic sense, thinking about the heritage through the military, but also in terms of geology and physical geography, thinking about the way that when there's contest over land, it's not simply contest over land as some kind of abstract thing, as it might be over money or some other kind of resource. It's also taking place on the very thing that the contest is over. That it's what I've called the site and the stake of struggle. It's the thing that's being fought for as well as fought on in terms of the kind of relations that are going on in that sense. Both of those seem to me to be important, but both of those seem to me to be only part of the story about thinking about territory. So what I try to do in the work in a conceptual sense, and then try to work this through historically, which is where Shakespeare will come into this in a moment, is to think land and terrain as important but not sufficient to understand the question of territory. And the two main areas that I've suggested we need to take much more seriously if we're to think about a much more adequate sense of the question of territory, one is the political legal. So it's thinking about questions of power and authority, notions of sovereignty or earlier ideas of supremacy or superiority, notions of administration, notions of jurisdiction, and to think about them in terms of where they apply. To what do they apply? Where does this law apply and where does that law start to apply? When does this law cease to apply? So the whole question of the conflict of laws, what law applies over a particular question in a particular location, this seems to me to be important in understanding the question of territory. The particular question I've put up here, when the notion of territorium, classical Latin, but a very rare word in classical Latin, when did that notion become the object of political rule, the thing over which political rule was actually exercised? Answering that question, it seems to me, makes a lot of sense of the emergence of territory as a question. And I can talk much more about all of this in questions if people want to. The second is what I'm calling the political technical. So this is really trying to think through the way a whole set of techniques or arts or practices influence the way that we think about the question of territory. So it's how did advances in mathematics, techniques based on calculation, particularly developments in geometry, how did these change the way that we made maps? How did these change the way that we made large-scale land surveying projects? How did this change military strategies? How did all of this serve the state in terms of controlling a much larger area than political rulers controlled in the past, or at least a much more closely detailed, fine-grained way of controlling those particular areas? And you can link this to the emergence of statistics, of political arithmetic, to censuses and so on. Different types of techniques based on a particular understanding of calculation that influences these practices and feeds into the story of the question of territory. So this is what I mean by this notion, which I borrow from Foucault, of territory as a political technology, or perhaps as a bundle of political technology, thinking about not land and terrain as if they're some kind of sort of inert thing in which things happen or on which things happen, but thinking of these as active, as changed by processes, changed by techniques, or things that are done to them in order to understand what's going on through this notion of territory. So for me, territory isn't a product, but is much more of a process. It's something that's continually made and remade, rather than being something that's static and inert and simply has these things are done in it. So territory, for me, obviously a political question, but political, I hope, in a more expanded sense of the political, by taking into account not simply the economic and the strategic, but also the legal and the technical to think about it. So it seems to me that if we try to think about territory as the bounded space under a control of a group of people, the sort of political geography 101 definition, that seems to me to ask the questions rather than to provide the answers. What do we mean by bounded? How do we understand space? How do we understand the control or the political control of space? Those seem to me the questions that we need to ask rather than themselves are the answers to that. Now, two books on territory that I've written, one of them is a very political book, it's been out for a couple of years, looking about how questions of territory can help us to understand what's been happening in the War on Terror the last 10, 12 years or so. But I try to trace it back into sort of an earlier historical period, particularly the changes since the end of the Cold War, to try to look at a set of political and legal questions around the notion of territorial integrity particularly. And then the historical book, the one that's coming out about June next year, which is a much broader, much longer historical period, trying to trace the emergence of this concept in Western political thought, to try to go back to the canonical text, but also a range of other texts, to trace how this concept came to be something that I think we take relatively unproblematically today. And this apologies for the size, this is the only one that has point size down this small. This is the table of contents for the book. It's a very big book. It's 200,000 word book, sort of 500 plus pages when actually printed. And it goes from ancient Greek myth and tragedy up to the beginning of the 18th century, trying to look at Western political thought really with one guiding question. What's the relation between place and power? And out of those particular ways of ordering that relation, how does this notion of territory and territorial sovereignty and its linking to the notion of the state, how does that emerge? And I'm not going to even begin to try to walk you through what the book actually does, the types of thinkers that I look at. But one of the things I tried to argue is actually that the canonical thinkers, the sort of thinkers that would be taught in a survey history of political thought class, are actually not the most important people in this story. That the kind of the Hobbes, Locke, Rousseau type figures are actually minor figures in this story. They're major figures in other stories, but they're relatively minor in this story. That actually, if we're looking at the 17th century, the most important people are people writing in Germany. People like Johannes Arthusius, Andreas Knicken, Gottfried Leibniz, much better known as a philosopher, but an important political thinker. That some of the late medieval thinkers are very important in clarifying the relation between political power and spiritual power, the power of the church, and who has jurisdiction over certain types of questions. Legal thinkers become important in this. So a whole range of questions that I tried to open up in doing this way of thinking about this history of political thought set of questions. And in there, right at the end of chapter 8, is Shakespeare. And the idea was that I had a plan for writing a short paper on King Lear that would fit nicely into this, because King Lear is a play that is about the division of territory right in that opening scene of the first act. And I thought this would make a nice example to sit alongside the reading of Beowulf, the reading of Antigone that are in other chapters there. And it became much, much bigger than I ever imagined. It became far too big to fit in this book. And then it expanded and it kept getting bigger. And so this is why I'm talking today about Shakespeare and territory. Now, Shakespeare only uses... Sorry, that's the book manuscript. sorry, let me go back to that. That's the 800-page manuscript just before I sent it to Chicago, the funding for it. Now, Shakespeare doesn't use the word territory very often at all. There's only two plays where that word appears, and then one of them in King Lear, it only appears in the folio edition of the text. The quarto doesn't have the word there. So there's a set of textual issues, which I'll talk much more about when I come to Hamlet later, that also are important in some of the questions I'm doing. It's also there in As You Like It. Territories in the plural is there in a few plays. But it's often used almost as if it means lands. These are the territories, I banish you from my territories, or something like that. It doesn't seem to have a particularly important resonance in those plays. And one of those plays there, Edward III, not a canonical Shakespeare text, generally accepted to have some elements written by Shakespeare, but the scene in which territories appears is generally thought not to have been written by Shakespeare. So you can see that if we're simply looking at it in terms of counting up the words, it doesn't appear to be a major issue for Shakespeare in his writing. And yet Shakespeare talks about a whole range of questions that are related to the question of territory in his plays. Exile and banishment, land politics, spatial division, who controls political spaces, contestation, the conquest, the succession of territories, who is able to exchange those territories through marriage, through the conquest in war, through peace settlements and so on. These kinds of issues, it seems to me, are all through Shakespeare's plays. And that perhaps there's something in that that can help us to understand the question of territory. Because the other thing, the other reason why I think Shakespeare is potentially interesting is the time that he's writing, the late 16th, early 17th century, is precisely the moment in Western political thought that the notion of territory is starting to really coalesce as this really important way of ordering the relations between politics and place. Shakespeare, I think, at that moment, the sort of cusp moment in between these different ways of ordering our political space, he might help us to understand the varying aspects, the alternatives, the tensions, the ambiguities, the limits of some of these questions. Shakespeare, of course, is writing in England. Shakespeare's England at the time, this is the late Elizabethan through to the early Jacobean period. This is a space that at his time is relatively ordered and bordered, and yet its recent history, the thing that he explores in his history plays, is anything but. The War of the Roses, the other kinds of challenges between the religion, the confessional wars, these kinds of issues, and these are wars that are continuing on in Europe at the time that he's writing, these kinds of things show a fractured space, a contested, polarised, polemical problem space. Shakespeare, I think, opens up some of those questions in some of his plays. King Lear, which I've already mentioned, is a play that's set in a kind of semi-mythical British past, but it's a play about the kind of contestation of who controls and who owns and who regulates and who orders types of political spaces. Some of Shakespeare's Roman plays think about these kinds of questions as well. Coriolanus is my example on that. In The Tempest, Shakespeare talks about the colonial, thinking about colonial spaces, the conquest of the New World, the domination and the control of those kinds of spaces. In Titus Andronicus, he talks about what might be outside of territory or outside of territorial orderings, as I think he also does in As You Like It. So the idea is that through readings of a relatively small number of Shakespeare's plays, I can open up different aspects of the question of territory and use this as a way of explaining the complexity of the notion of territory, but to do it in a different way, and I hope a slightly more exciting way than the rather dry history of political thought account that I've offered in the previous work. Now, that's another long sort of book-type project here. I'm not going to try and talk about all of those elements again today. What I'm going to do is talk about one of those chapters, and only really a part of that chapter, which is chapter 6, on external powers and the kind of sense of the vulnerability of a territory, the threat from outside that might be faced. And I'm going to particularly focus on Hamlet and hope I have a little time to say something about Macbeth. Both Hamlet and Macbeth focus on what happens when somebody takes control of a political unit, a polity, a kingdom, or so on. In both plays, you have the previous ruler murdered, and the person who murdered them takes political control. So in Hamlet, King Hamlet, the father, has been killed by his brother. His brother, Claudius, becomes the king in his place. In Macbeth, Macbeth kills the king, Duncan, and he becomes the ruler in his place. Both of them then seem to be about the challenge, the threat from inside, somebody within either very close family relations or somebody who's within the inner circle of controls. But what I want to try and suggest is actually both of these plays are structured much, certainly in a very important way, by the threats from the outside of those territories. In Hamlet, the very beginning of the play refers to a battle between Denmark and Norway, in which King Hamlet, this is the title character, Hamlet's father, King Hamlet has killed the Norwegian king, Fortinbras. Both kings are now dead. One of them died in that battle, the other has been murdered by his brother. And it's the namesake sons of these two kings, Fortinbras of Norway and Hamlet of Denmark, that are both seeking revenge in this play. Hamlet's revenge story is, of course, the one that we all know about. What I'm going to try and suggest is that Fortinbras' story is also important in the structure of this play. Both of them seeking revenge. So Hamlet's seeking revenge over his uncle, who's killed his father, and Fortinbras is seeking revenge over Denmark as a whole. Now, Denmark, the term, the word Denmark, the proper noun Denmark, functions both as a place and as a person in the play. Sometimes when Denmark is referred to, it means the king, and sometimes it means the place over which that king has power. So the dead king is sometimes referred to as Denmark, such as in the opening scene, as when Horatio addresses the ghost. What art thou that thus usurps this time of night, together with that fair and warlike form in which the majesty of buried Denmark did sometimes march? It's a slightly variant form in one of the other texts there, where it's actually that usurps the state, and the notion of the state is a term that keeps coming back through the play, that it means both the political unit, the state, but also the older sense of the term state, the status or the standing of a political ruler in those actions. So there's this sense that the ghost that is being seen resembles the father that has been killed, the old king that has been killed. So the people keeping watch, Horatio and his colleagues, are seeing the ghost, they're seeing this visible resemblance of the majesty of old Denmark. And that there's the line, and I'm going to talk about the complexities of this, but the description that Horatio makes of this ghost, this apparition that he's seen, was such was the very armour he had on when he, the ambitious Norway, combated. So frowned he once when in an angry pile he smote the sledded poleaxe on the ice. Now there's some complexities in those lines that I want to try and tease out. Norway here refers to the king as much as the country, so again a person and a place in that register. But the thing I want to focus on is this idea of the sledded poleaxe. Now I should say that Polak at this time, the general consensus that Polak is not a derogatory term to describe people from Poland as it has become in North America today, but it's simply the way that we would use the word Pole, somebody from Poland, the people of Poland. Sledded poleaxe then is generally taken to mean Polish soldiers or a formation of Polish soldiers in sledges or on sledges on the ice. So a kind of an Arctic force that are using sledges as their means of transport to get themselves from one battle to another. And you have this heroic king who's combated Norway and has destroyed these sledded Polacks, that he has come into a confrontation with them and he has defeated this military force. The problem is the texts are incredibly corrupt and the texts have different things for that line. And there's a possibility that Polacks actually means a pole axe, which is a particular kind of weapon, a long pole with a sharp edge to it. And that it may actually mean he himself had this kind of weapon which he smacked onto the ice. This is a way that he was combating Norway. He was challenging him by breaking the ice or by showing his force by smashing the ice. What is sledded here? Well, it might mean leaded. It might mean like a sledgehammer, a type of fortification to the pole axe that he is carrying. But for my purposes, certainly the consensus view is actually much more useful, that he's talking about two different military confrontations, one with Norway and one with Poland. And particularly because Poland comes back in later in the play, this is actually quite important in terms of the story here. And this angry parle is an interesting thing that Shakespeare does here. A parle, a parley, a negotiation, what would usually be a peaceful settlement, it's turning into an angry parle, in other words, a confrontation, a head-to-head confrontation. Instead of speaking, they were fighting at that particular point. Now, the combat with Norway is the one that is outlined in some detail, but Poland comes back as important later on. Long quotation. I'm going to read through it, and then I'm going to go back and try and explain what I think is going on in these two slides here. So our last king, whose image even but now appeared to us, was, as you know, by Fortinbras of Norway, thereto pricked on by a most eminent pride, dared to the combat in which our valiant Hamlet, for though this side of our known world esteemed him, this is the father Hamlet, did slay this Fortinbras, again the father, who by a sealed compact, well ratified by law and heraldry, did forfeit with his life all these his lands, which he stood seized of to the conqueror, against the which a moiety competent was gaged by our king, which had returned to the inheritance of Fortinbras, had he been vanquisher, as by the same comart and carriage of the article design, his fell to Hamlet. I am going to try and explain what I think that means for those who are struggling to follow this. Now, sir, young Fortinbras of unimproved metal, hot and full, hath in the skirts of Norway here and there sharked up a list of lawless resolutes for food and diet to some enterprise that hath a stomach in it, which is no other, as it doth well appear unto the state, but to recover of us by strong hand and terms compensatory that those foresaid lands so by his father lost. And this, I take it, is the main motive of our preparations, the source of this our watch, and the chief head of this post-haste and rummage in this land. Right, let me go back to the previous one and try and explain this, and then I'll come on to the second part of the quotation. A long quotation, but actually a very compressed narrative. Several decades are being talked about in this period of time. Hamlet, the father, the old king. Hamlet has slain Fortinbras of Norway after being provoked by him into combat. By his death, Fortinbras has forfeited lands to Hamlet, which was an agreement that was sworn is legally just and in accordance with the rules of chivalry. The lands of which he was in legal possession are passed not to his son by inheritance, but to Hamlet, the father, by conquest. There's debate as to whether these are personal lands or those of the kingdom, but it's clear that this was not the entirety of the kingdom, because the next line suggests that the lands forfeited by Fortinbras have been balanced by a moiety competent. Moiety competent means an equivalent portion of land that was gauged, i.e. wagered, that was bet by Hamlet. So that this combat basically meant that they both pledged lands, and whoever won would gain the lands from the other in that combat. So had Hamlet fallen, those lands would have passed to Fortinbras. As it was, Fortinbras' land went to Hamlet. The second part of it, young Fortinbras, the dead king's son, refuses to accept this state of affairs. And we later discover, this is in the gravedigger scene much later in the play, we discover that this combat actually happened on the day of Hamlet the son's birth, so some distance back in the past. Now young Fortinbras, the son, wishes to prove himself and has roused in the borderlands, the outskirts of Norway, a group of men to form an army. Who are those men? Well, the quarto text, the one that I have here, calls them lawless resolutes, a group that seems to not have any legal affiliation, not any kind of moral sense, but they're resolved, that they're determined that they want to transform this and change this. But actually, the other version of the text has landless resolutes, people, possibly second sons, people who don't have land themselves, haven't inherited land, as of course Fortinbras himself has not inherited land because he was cheated out of it by this combat between the two fathers. So it's either lawless or landless resolutes that are going with Fortinbras to try and challenge the state of affairs to overturn this maybe 20, 30 years afterwards. Fortinbras, and the name literally means strong in arm, Fortinbras threatens with a strong hand, we're told, to recover the lands that his father lost a generation before. And it's for that purpose that there are the guards on the battlements of Elsinore Castle at the beginning, because they are there keeping watch to make sure that Fortinbras and his forces are not there to attack Denmark. That's the reason for that setup at the beginning of the play, is because they feel that there's this risk of, in the last line here, the cause of urgency and disturbance, or the post-haste and rummage in the land. So Denmark is a threatened place. It's worried about the threat of an external invasion. So this gives some sense, I think, of a kind of claustrophobic sense that you have in Denmark throughout the play. It's worried about being threatened from the outside. And in the next scene, when some of the major characters enter, we discover why Fortinbras has chosen this moment, 20, maybe 30 years after the initial cause of the grievance, why has he chosen this moment to launch this potential attack? Well, it's because the king is dead and a new king has just taken control. So Claudius notes his brother's death. Of course, he doesn't say that he was the one who murdered him, but he says that this is the reason why Fortinbras now feels empowered, or now feels emboldened, to come after Denmark to threaten it. The succession has apparently meant that he feels that the state of Denmark is vulnerable. Now follows, says Claudius, that you know young Fortinbras holding a weak supposal of our worth, or thinking by our late dear brother's death, our states to be disjoint and out of frame, co-leagued with the dream of his advantage, he hath not failed to pester us with message, importing the surrender of those lands lost by his father with all bounds of law to our most valiant brother. Now that tells us little beyond what Horatio has already explained, except that it is the reason why young Fortinbras thinks this might be the time to overturn this long state of affairs. Denmark, he thinks, is now vulnerable, it's militarily weak, and he's making these demands for the return of the lands. Claudius notes here again, these were legally agreed. It's not simply by conquest, but there was some kind of legal compact that made these lands pass to Hamlet. He's dismissive of Fortinbras, but he wants to make sure, and so he sends courtiers, emissaries, from his court to Norway. This is the king of Norway, an old man. So much for him, i.e. for Fortinbras. Now for ourselves and for this time of meeting, thus much the business is, we have here writ to Norway, uncle of young Fortinbras, who impotent and bedrid, scarcely hears of this his nephew's purpose, to suppress his further gate herein, in that the levies, the lists, and full proportions are all made out of his subject, and we here dispatch you, good Cornelius, and you, Voltemann, for bearers of this greeting to old Norway, giving to you no further personal power to business with the king more than the scope of these dilated articles allow. Farewell, and let your haste commend your duty. So what we discover here is that, as in Denmark, it is the king's brother rather than his son that has inherited the throne. Norway, this obviously makes sense. Fortinbras was obviously a child when his father was killed by King Hamlet. Though in Denmark, of course, the succession is very open to question. When Claudius kills Father Hamlet, why doesn't young Hamlet succeed to the throne? And of course, for that story, the main story that everybody knows about Hamlet, that's obviously one of the major issues, is why has Hamlet been cheated out of the throne? And also, why is he going to, or is he going to revenge his father's death? But the contrast here that's made between old Norway and Claudius, the new king of Denmark, is stark. One of them is bedridden and impotent. The other makes a great play through the whole action of his own bedridden potency. He's not only murdered Hamlet's father, he's married Hamlet's mother. And this is the thing that kind of inspires the Oedipus reading that Freud made of the play in terms of what sorts of sexual relations are going on within Denmark at that point. Claudius then wants to take no chances. He wants to get Norway to rein in his nephew, much as he wishes to control his own nephew back in Denmark. And diplomatic means rather than military force are the things that he's trying to use to deflect the Norwegian invasion. And the ambassadors return in Act 2, bearing a message from Norway. I'm not going to read the whole of this quotation, but the argument is, the message that comes back from Norway is that Norway didn't realise that Fortinbras was about to attack Denmark. He thought he was going to attack Poland, and he was simply going to go through Denmark in order to reach Poland and to launch an attack there. The Denmark becomes like a passage to get to Poland. When he actually realises this, he wants to rein in his nephew. He doesn't want a war or to reopen the old wounds of the conflict with Denmark. And so he prevents him from doing this. He orders him to cease and gets him to swear that he will not attack Denmark. He rewards Fortinbras with an annual allowance and sends him on to attack the Poles, as he thought he was going to do in the first place. But in order to make that happen, he has to enter into a contract with Denmark to actually allow safe passage of these forces over his lands. So he has to be allowed safe passage through Danish dominions to make this possible, and is something that Claudius seems willing to accept. This is the price, really, of not being attacked himself. He's going to allow the Norwegian forces through Denmark in order to reach Poland. And then we hear no more of Fortinbras for a lot of the play. He doesn't appear again until Act 4. And so a large part of the play, all of the story that we know of Hamlet dithering around, am I going to murder my father, what am I going to do, what am I going to do, all this kind of stuff, happens with all of this Fortinbras and Norway stuff off stage, seemingly resolved, seemingly peripheral, seemingly not important to what's going on in the play. But the two times that Fortinbras comes back into the play seem to me to be really important in terms of this overall story and important in terms of the kind of, what I'm calling this claustrophobic sense of Denmark, obsessed with its own problems, but forgetting what's going on in the wider world around it. So Fortinbras comes back in at the beginning of Act 4 at the head of an army, and he sends a messenger to greet the Danish king, Claudius. Go, captain, from me greet the Danish king. Tell him that by his license, Fortinbras craves the conveyance of a promised march over his kingdom. You know the rendezvous. If that his majesty would aught with us, we shall express our duty in his eye and let him know so. And the first quarto has a slightly different text at that point. This is basically calling in the agreement that had been made previously. The Norwegian forces are allowed their passage over the lands of Denmark in order to get to Poland. He wishes to inform Denmark of this rather than simply march his forces. This is why he sends this messenger to go and greet the king. He says in the first version of this here that if he will aught with us, if he actually wants to talk about this, then I will meet him face to face in his eye. I will actually talk to him about this. But it's clear that he's not really going to think this is up for negotiations. It's more of a formal courtesy in terms of marching his army across there. So either with respect or safely in the knowledge that they will not be challenged, Fortinbras and his army exit from the stage. Hamlet then appears, and he bumps into the captain on his way to meet the Danish king. Hamlet at this point is being exiled to England. Hamlet is being taken out of the story by his uncle Claudius, because Claudius is so worried about what Hamlet might be doing to him. And he actually sends Hamlet to England with a message that when Hamlet reaches England, the English court should kill Hamlet. So he's trying to get rid of Hamlet, both spatially, to try and get him out of Denmark, but also trying to get rid of him generally in terms of moving him off the stage, but also moving him out of the story overall. Now, Hamlet enters into a discussion with the captain, asking about what these forces are, this army that he can clearly see that is being headed up by Fortinbras. Who is this army? Whose powers are these? And then he asks, goes it against the main of Poland, sir, or for some frontier? And there's some complexities again here in terms of the sort of geographies going on about. The main is the mainland, but the frontier is ambiguous. The Oxford English Dictionary actually uses this as the first instance of frontier not meaning simply a line or a region, but a fortress on a frontier, that they may be actually acting against in a sort of a siege sense of trying to attack a particular fort or fortress that is in a certain part of Poland. But it's also clearly the sense of a frontier, a border, a peripheral area in terms of it. And contrasting this with the main, are they going against the main part of the country or some peripheral island or some less important region, perhaps? And indeed, the way that the captain replies to this suggests, I think, that second reading of it. Truly to speak, and with no addition, we go to gain a little patch of ground that hath in it no profit but the name. To pay 5 ducats, 5, I would not farm it, nor will it yield to Norway or the Pole a ranker rate should it be sold in fee. So the captain, who presumably has some kind of experience of farming, perhaps he's a farmer in his civilian life, perhaps he was a farmer in a previous life before he joined the army, he sees the target, the thing they're going to go and fight about, as having little more than a vanity aspect to it in terms of conquest. He notes that it's already garrisoned by forces. He recognises that both sides have a stake in its possession, that there's going to be some kind of challenge and fight over it. And Hamlet notes that 2,000 souls, or then later 20,000 men, will fight over this plot of land, which is actually not even big enough to bury the dead that are likely to result from this contest. Hamlet says it's not tomb enough and continent to hide the slain. So it's a tiny piece of land. It's probably for some kind of prestige value rather than perhaps the resources that are in there or some other kind of strategic sense to it. But what's crucial about this scene, it seems to me, in terms of the wider play, is that Hamlet, this person who I've suggested is dithering around, not sure what he's going to do, has opportunities, doesn't act on them, and so on. Hamlet sees Fortinbras, his near contemporary, acting in such a resolute, determined way. Fortinbras isn't messing around, he's actually doing the things that he intends to do, perhaps rashly, but he's actually acting on his impulses. He's doing the things that he decides that he wants to do. And Hamlet, from that moment on, seems to stop dithering. Hamlet actually starts to do things. Hamlet realises that when he arrives in England, he's going to be killed, so he switches the letter that's accompanying him to actually mean that the people that are accompanying him, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, are killed instead. Hamlet ends up having a negotiation with pirates that capture him, paying a ransom and getting back to Denmark. And when he arrives in Denmark, he actually starts to be active in terms of seeking vengeance over the person who killed his father, the new king. So Hamlet seems to, in some sense, take an inspiration from the way that Fortinbras, the head of this military force, is acting, and it turns his own resolution on the basis of this. The next moment, then, that Fortinbras comes back in the play is in that final scene. This is the scene where Hamlet and Laertes are fighting, where Claudius has tried to poison Hamlet, ends up poisoning his wife instead. All the bodies start to pile up. It's kind of like most Shakespeare tragedies, the body count rises towards the end of the play. What happens? Fortinbras appears on the scene. And Osric, this is a courtier, says, young Fortinbras with conquest comes from Poland. Presumably he's gained this tiny patch of land that he was fighting over, and he's coming back, presumably again through the same route of passage that allows him to get back into his own lands of Norway. And the ambassadors of England have arrived, presumably to say, we've done what you asked us to do in the letter, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead, in that famous line of the play. But the forces then are converging on the Danish court, just as all of the people that might legitimately be the Danish king are dead. Because Claudius is dead, Hamlet, who is his presumed heir, is dying, Laertes, who might also have a claim to the throne, is dead. The whole set of people that might inherit the crown are dead. Who is it that ends up as the king of Denmark? It's Fortinbras. Fortinbras is named by Hamlet in Hamlet's dying words, the speech here that he directs to Horatio, that he says that he's going to hand this throne over to Fortinbras. He has my dying voice, he has my dying vote, or he has my kind of permission or my sanction or my recommendation to the court. Fortinbras, he is the person that will have this. The rest is silence, the famous last words of Hamlet in that play. So Hamlet is dead. Fortinbras is about to assume the throne of the place that his father had lost in the combat with King Hamlet before. And Fortinbras comes in and he sees all these bodies piled up and he just says, such a sight as this becomes the field, the battlefield. But here, i.e. kind of here in a stateroom, here inside the palace, something's kind of gone wrong, shows much amiss. And he says, I've slightly switched these around in terms of explaining it, but he makes this claim, for me, with sorrow I embrace my fortune, i.e. this inheritance, i.e. becoming the king in the place of all of these dead people. I have some rights of memory in this kingdom, in other words, the inheritance from his father who had lost this land in an earlier time, which now to claim my vantage doth invite me. So he's trying to make sense of the fact that he's arrived, coming back from Poland at the head of an army, comes into the court, finds all of the people dead, and ends up being made the king of Denmark at that point. It's the threat from the outside becoming the thing that actually takes over and controls what's going on in that particular place. Now, if I had more time, and I'm conscious of the time, if I had more time, then I would talk a little bit about Hamlet and Hamlet's time in Saxony at the beginning of the play, or about what happens when he's over in England, or about Laertes' period in France and his own return to find his father has been murdered at that point. All of the son-father relations, it seems to me, in that play map onto geopolitical themes or questions. Let me just say a little bit about the way that this is turned into plays on the stage or films that you might be able to watch. The bit I've talked about, the whole thing I've talked about here, is quite often dropped in adaptations. You may know Shakespeare's plays, particularly the tragedies, tend to be very long, and that if you actually read every line in Hamlet, it would be well over 4 hours. Most people realise that this is not actually very practical in terms of staging, and also the idea of pulling a full army onto stage is not a particularly practical thing either. So it's often dropped, and some directors have made a kind of virtue out of this. They've said, oh, we drop this because these scenes are boring, or because these scenes don't really add to the story, or actually really what we need to focus on is the domestic and the internal drama. We don't need to look at this wider setting, that this gets in the way. Some of them have even made the claim that these are later additions into the text, but the suggestion I've made of reading those three variant versions of the text, elements of this story are in all of them, even if there's some differences. So that doesn't seem to me to be very plausible. But it seems to me, and this is the point I'm trying to make, it actually makes a great deal of sense of what's going on in the story, and actually, to me, adds to this very claustrophobic sense of what's going on inside of Denmark, to have this wider framing, the wider battles and so on, that it's almost this kind of self-obsessed internal struggle when you're forgetting the kind of the bigger things that are going on in the world outside. And that seems to be the kind of court politics sense that's going on in that play. It makes a great deal of sense to me to have that geopolitical frame because it helps to explain some of the things in terms of motivation, but also in terms of what is actually at stake in those kinds of struggles. And in the play, it seems that Denmark is revealed to be a very small pocket of land surrounded by dangerous enemies, by Norway and by Poland. It's a passage route from Norway to Poland. It's one of those countries that can't really dictate the terms of its own, what we'd now call territorial integrity, but has to allow a dominant regional power to march through its lands in order to sort out its enemies on the other side of it. Hamlet declares in one of the versions of the text that Denmark is a prison, which seems to me to make sense of that idea. It's this very small, enclosed, claustrophobic space in there. That the land that they're in, the land that Claudius, that Hamlet are contesting, is land that actually was gained by Hamlet the father through that exchange with Fortinbras, through that killing of Fortinbras at the beginning of the play. And that the internal feuding in the end opens up the possibility for Fortinbras, the threat from the outside, to come in and take over, to dominate and to control the area that he's in. It seems to me that the most effective for this part of the story, if perhaps not for other parts, is Kenneth Branagh's version of Hamlet, shot with a much bigger budget than many of the other adaptations that you find. But it shows these as a very claustrophobic set of rooms running around inside Blenheim Palace, for the most part, in terms of the filming of the play. And then in just those few scenes, the Fortinbras scenes, pulling out to a much more panoramic sense of looking at the kind of the wider geopolitical world that's going on outside of this very self-obsessed and internally focused set of questions that are going on inside there. Now, I'm going to skip over the two other examples that I use to try to illustrate some of these themes. One of them is Macbeth, and the other one is Othello. I try and talk about Othello in terms of the Cyprus Wars. This is one of the things that's given Othello his position within Venetian societies, his success in warfare, and that the last four acts of Othello are set in Cyprus, in the kind of colonial setting of Venice in terms of its control of the Eastern Mediterranean. So there's a whole set of questions about the Ottoman Empire and Venice struggling for supremacy in that particular area. And in Macbeth, of course, Macbeth gains his position by killing the previous king. But he gains his earlier status within Scotland through his success in seeing off Scotland's external enemies, the threat from Norway, Ireland, and the traitors within Scotland, right in the opening scene of the play. And at the end, Macbeth is undone by much the same kind of thing. It's actually the dead king's sons who've gone off to England and Ireland, who then bring their forces back into Scotland to overthrow Scotland. So it's the external threats that transform what happens in Scotland at that time. So both of those plays also, seems to me, open up some of the same kinds of aspects that I've suggested are there within Hamlet. I want to leave time for a good number of questions, so let me come back and make just some concluding comments. So other parts of this project, that's a bit of one of the chapters within this. Other parts try and discuss different aspects of territory. So questions of division and the politics of land, the political economy of land, the corporeal nature of the body, the idea that the state is some kind of political body. That's a reading of Coriolanus, some of you may have seen the recent Ray Fiennes version of Coriolanus is a reimagined in a kind of a semi-mythical Balkans setting, which works quite well in terms of those kinds of issues. The legal questions through reading of Henry V, particularly about the inheritance of lands and whether Henry can lay claim to France or not through a peculiar, complicated set of legal machinations. The colonial, the technical, what might lie outside of territory, as in the ways that I think you can see that in As You Like It and in Titus Andronicus. And the point that I want to make with that is if we now say that we're outside of British territory, we're in some other territory. We cross a border, and if we cross a border, we leave France, we end up in Germany or in Belgium. In previous times, when you left a territory, you didn't necessarily end up immediately in another territory. There were places that were outside of what we might now call territorial orderings, no man's land, dangerous marshlands, forests, mountainous regions, uninhabited areas, the kind of thing that really we only now have in something like the notion of the high seas. What it means to be outside of territorial orderings, for places to be outside of regulated political space. And I think that Shakespeare is writing just at the moment when that's starting to disappear, just when the map is starting to close in, where everything starts to join up and that borders become as we imagine them today. I think Shakespeare still has some sense of an older way of ordering political space. And that's really one of the reasons why I suggest that Shakespeare is helpful in terms of this wider project and on sovereign territory. He's writing at that time when the modern notion of sovereign territory is emerging. And so I think he can open up some of the ways that there are still variant ways of political spatial ordering. There are still tensions, ambiguities, limits to the way of thinking the notion of territory. So for me, Shakespeare is helpful conceptually, historically, politically in thinking about territory. And I've picked these plays not necessarily because they're the most famous or because they're my favourites, but because they open up particular aspects of the question of territory that I think are worthwhile in there. The suggestion that I'm making that territory is a political and a geographical concept, that much is generally accepted, but I want to try and tease out the economic, the strategic, the legal, the technical, the social, the cultural, the emotional, affective, these kinds of dimensions of territory. And so because territory has such a complicated history and it has all of these different elements, Shakespeare, for me, helps me to elucidate some of those different aspects. Thank you.
We're going to go over to the floor for some questions. Is it all right if I take a couple at a time? Is that okay?
As you wish, I'll try. If you want me to try and join things up, I'll try.
Okay, it won't take 2 minutes. Got okay. One there. That's great.
Thanks a lot. I thought it was really interesting. I was just wondering, your reading of Hamlet and Macbeth, especially Hamlet, obviously, refer to notions of sovereignty, the state, and so on. For me, they resemble a lot, you know, the Max Weberian idea of the state, clear, demarcated borders, you know, sovereignty as, you know, an internal thing. And you talked about internal and external threats, and I thought about what Foucault said about coup d'état, which is an attack on, not on the state at all, but more or less supporting the state as such. And external threats that you talked about are not doing away with the idea of sovereignty as such. So in the more contemporary context, I was wondering, you know, because in your reading, the structure as such doesn't really change. It is, you know, the traditional reading of territory, of space, of who controls what, and so on, and by what means. So in our contemporary fragmentation of, you know, sovereignty, if you look at the EU, for instance, I was wondering that you can't just, you know, do away with a leader and take over state power if you want. So, like, who would we have to kill to take over the state?
I've got two more over here, and then we'll come back to you, okay? Charles, do you want to?
Hi, thank you for your talk. It's fascinating. I've got two interconnected questions. The first one is, I'd like to hear a bit more about something that you said right at the end about how reading Shakespeare through the lens of territory helps us to kind of look with a fresh eye at the question of territory. What relevance might this reading of Shakespeare have for the way we imagine territory today? How exactly is it challenging the way we think or the way territory is commonly thought. Because I mean, you were talking about these different meanings of territory in this play, and in a way, it was interesting to see these things coming up. These themes, but these are themes that we are, to a great extent, very familiar with. The idea of territory as the private property of the sovereign that can be transferred, that can be inherited, etc. So I'm just wondering, how does this help us beyond the historiographical interest? Well, how does this help us think about territory today? And secondly, it's kind of connected to it, I think, is the fact that when you're talking, because this is also connected with this kind of personal conception of territory as a personal property, which is the question of population, because territory also contains the population that lives within it. So when a ruler inherited the territory, it also inherited the population. So when can we understand territory without taking into account the relationship between the territory and the population that lives within it? And what's the consequence of that to the kind of stuff you're trying to do?
Thanks. I'll take one more and then I'll come back to you. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
I just have a small question. Like when Hamlet hand the kingdom over to Fortinbras, what authority does he have to hand the power over? Because like he killed his uncle, which is a king, and that is kind of an illegitimate way to seize power.
Shall I try and say something about, maybe I'll take that last one first. Hamlet, this is the son Hamlet, is named as the heir to Claudius. In the first scene of the major play. So you have the scene on the battlements where they first see the ghost, and then you go inside to the castle, and Claudius names Hamlet. Hamlet has recently returned to the kingdom. He'd been away in Germany. He'd just come back to he found his father's dead, his uncle has taken the throne, his uncle has married his mother, and he says, there's a line where he says, you know, that the hot food that they ate at the funeral was the cold meats used the next day in the wedding. It's kind of a really compressed narrative for him. He's discovered this situation. And he is named in that scene as the heir to Claudius. Claudius is basically adopting him as his son in that move. So that by that law of succession, in terms of the way that this has already been proclaimed, Hamlet knows that he should inherit. The whole question that runs through the play is, Hamlet thinks, I should have inherited it straight away had my father died. And then when he discovers that Claudius has killed his father in order to get this thing, he thinks that even more strongly. So in a strictly legal sense, it seems to me to make sense that because Claudius dies three or four lines before Hamlet, Hamlet is actually the king at the moment that he dies, and so in his dying words he's able to hand it over to Fortinbras. That would seem to make sense in terms of the handing over the lineage, but also because nobody else is alive that could lay claim to it, because the bodies are piled up by this point. So I think it's a kind of a sense along those lines. But you're absolutely right that the way that he's gained that is dubious and illegitimate and so on, that people might make that claim. I suspect the defence lawyer would mount the claim, well, Claudius tried to kill Hamlet first, and Hamlet was killing him largely in self-defence. Also because Claudius has just accidentally poisoned his wife, Hamlet's mother, you know, this kind of... I think they'd use that as the in mitigation of what's actually happened. But it makes sense structurally, I think, to have that handing over, because it closes the whole big story. Not the story that you see in the 4 hours in the theatre, but the whole backstory that it's referring to in terms of the combat between the murdered king and Fortinbras 20, 30, however many years past. It makes sense structurally as a closing off. But that's my sense of how it can be that Hamlet has that right to name the successor through that. Territory population. I think I might take these in backwards order. Territory and population are definitely related, and it seems to me that any sufficient account of either needs to have an adequate account of the other. And yet I don't think many accounts of population have an adequate theory of territory, an adequate sense of the history of the concept of territory. The obvious one here is Foucault. Foucault's security, territory, population lectures have, in quite a short period of time, really changed the way that people talk about these kinds of questions. The problem is that almost everything Foucault says about territory in those lectures is wrong. It's demonstrably historically false. And I think it's really damaged the way that people think about these kinds of questions, because I think what it's meant is that this, the thing that Foucault says, and he says, I don't really want to suggest this, but I'm going to suggest it. And then he does, and then people have taken that very, very seriously. Foucault basically says that territory as the object of government gets displaced by population. That there's a shift away from the way that we understand political rule in the Middle Ages through to Machiavelli, is that the focus of political rule is over territory, and that actually something new emerges in this period that he's understanding through the space of security, governmentality, and so on, where population becomes the target, the object of government. My reading actually is, I think, a Foucauldian reading. I mean, I think it's an account that tries to make sense and make use of the same kinds of resources, intellectual and textual, that he's doing. But it actually says territory and population emerge as concepts around the same time, out of different earlier models. In terms of population, the idea of the populace or the people. In terms of territory, looser ideas of land or terrain. Both of these emerge at a similar time, and they emerge through precisely the same kinds of techniques that Foucault is thinking are important for population. So that the parallel to political arithmetic or the emergence of statistics, of censuses, of all that statistical data that's gathered in order to regulate the people, it's exactly the same kinds of things that are being done to make sense of political spaces. And it seems historically that these stories actually run in parallel rather than the way that Foucault sort of staggers them, that you had this earlier a sense of it. And so I make the claim territory actually emerges later than Foucault thinks it disappears. Because if you go back and read the people that Foucault thinks are crucial theorists of territory, Machiavelli, for instance, territory is just not there in Machiavelli. It's just not true to claim that Machiavelli focuses on territory as the object of rule. Plenty of the English and the French translations of Machiavelli have territory in there, but Machiavelli doesn't say that. What you find is translators are putting an object to verbs to try to make sense of what Machiavelli is saying. But Machiavelli is actually not saying that the prince should seek to control territory or to gain territory or to regulate territory. He's actually saying something different. And in the book on territory, I try to work that through in a lot of detail to show why I think Foucault has kind of misled us in terms of this story. But it seems to me that the kind of political technology argument that Foucault makes about population actually makes a lot more sense to the notion of territory. We can talk more about that if you want, but the questions are stacking up here. I hope that, taken as a whole, this project, the historical project and so on, open up different ways of thinking about the question of territory than the standard way. I'm aware that as a reading, you know, of a single play or part of a single chapter, that much of what I might be saying sounds kind of familiar to the way that we think about territory and the property and the possession and so on. And yet I think that some of those fairly familiar things have become so familiar that they're uncritically analysed. People don't actually dig into this idea. And that if you take the idea of that the territory is basically the property of a ruler, where does that idea come from? And how does that idea actually change into the idea that it is a state that controls a territory? Because it doesn't seem to me to make sense of an individual landowner controls land, and that a very, very powerful landowner controls a lot of land, and that is something like a territory. That seems to me to be part of the story, but it doesn't seem to be adequate to understanding. Because if political economies of property and land were sufficient, you'd have territory in the Middle Ages. But you don't. You have a very strongly defended very strong, clear sense of property and land, but you don't have a coherent and articulated sense of territory. Well, so then it may be important, but it doesn't seem to me to be sufficient to understanding it. And that's why I try and talk about the technologies, for instance, the strategic, a whole set of different relations. And so it's partly to examine some straightforward and under-examined notions. It's also partly to supplement them with other ways of thinking about those kinds of questions. And I would hope that, taken as a whole, this helps to shed light on contemporary politics and contemporary kinds of issues. And part of the reason that I wrote the Terror and Territory book was because every time I talked about the historical book, people said, that's all very well and interesting about the Middle Ages, but what's this got to do with anything going on in the world today? And so part of the point of that Terror and Territory book was to say a more historically and theoretically sophisticated notion of territory, which I'm trying to propose, actually helps to make sense of some of the things that are going on today in the world. And this relates to this question of sovereignty and about what kind of sovereignty and what kind of control of sovereignty. Because the way that sovereignty and territory have become so intertwined, we seem to think that that's a relatively straightforward and problematic way of thinking about it. But if you look at this in international law, in the United Nations Charter, the notion of territorial integrity, which is the thing that kept being invoked by Blair before he bombed somewhere, this was the sort of standard Blair, I invoke the territorial integrity of Afghanistan and Iraq and I'm fully supportive of it, and by the way, we're going to invade. What's actually at stake in that? Well, territorial integrity has two main things within it, but they have very different lineages. One of them is the idea that boundaries are fixed, that you can't just grab a bit of somebody else's territory. You can't gain it through marriage, you can't buy it, you can't conquer it, you can't do all of those kinds of things. And the other one is that within that territory, the state is the supreme ruler, that they have exclusive internal sovereignty and equal external sovereignty, the kind of fiction of international law that all states are equal, they're all sovereign within their own borders. Those two elements have very, very different histories. The idea that a ruler is supreme within their land, within the area they control, that the king is the king in his kingdom, that he is the supreme ruler in his kingdom, you can trace that back to 13th, 14th century legal texts. The idea, though, that the king's kingdom was fixed, that's much more of a 20th century notion. The idea that boundaries are fixed and that you don't grab bits of your neighbour, you don't punish them when you beat them at war, you don't gain them through some kind of dodgy alliance or whatever. So the treaties of Locarno, the Calabrian Pact in the early part of the 20th century are attempts in international law to fix territorial settlements. So you have two completely different historical lineages, and in the book I try to trace these in much more detail, that come together in a particular legal notion in the recent present, and that I think in the last 20 years or so have been pulled apart. And that's what I try and trace through that, but it's through that historically informed thing that I hope it can say something about what's going on today. I don't want to, I mean, I can talk and talk, you can tell, so let's take some more questions. Yeah.
Thanks. I thought that was a really evocative and creative way of opening up precisely the kind of questions, not least about the contemporary, that you're suggesting. So feeling provoked by it, I want to kind of offer a couple of things.
Sure.
Back to, in some ways you're suggesting that there are surprising resonances from Shakespearean categories. One that I think might well be the case is Ahad Obama, a very interesting figure in the sense that some ridiculous percentage of not just Republicans think that he's a Muslim and think that he is not a legitimate president because the so-called Berzin movement, because he's not born in the US. He's got the wrong kind of bottom. He's got the wrong kind of beliefs, apparently. None of this is true. None of it's true at all. And yet, it's become so widely believed. So the idea of, as you have it, the corporeal territories, or the embodiment, literally, metaphorically, otherwise. So that just simply struck me as something of continuing importance. And I've often wondered what underlies this unwillingness to accept the body of this black man as a president of the US. Something additional, potentially, and Shakespearean, it might fit in the folds of what you've got there, but it might be additional, I'm sure. Not so much what territory is or how it might be conceived, it's what territory does as well. You know, you're Macbeth better than me, but in Macbeth there are witches and there are tempests, and the land itself rebels against this usurpation, does it not? And so the nature as enfolded in territory as well does things. It's kind of active, and the furthest reaches of green political theory, there may well be a resonance there, but I don't necessarily want to pursue it. The final thing is the notion of outside territories. Clearly has a subject, is interesting today, I think, especially in terms of subjective perception. Being Australian, I can say this, but for many decades, perhaps not so much today, Australians had a view of Asia as somewhere a little dark and dangerous, and there were lots of people, and not many people here, and there was all this idea of the Red Peril, which was evoked in the 50s and 60s. Now, this was a construction of various kinds, a result of kind of historical paranoias of different kinds built on probably nothing. But in terms of subjective and collectively shared, possibly even national perceptions of threats from the outside, so the construction of the outside by political leaders or shared amongst citizens and subjects. Yep. Sorry, that's not a question now.
It's a what do you think question, isn't it?
Yeah.
Take one more, Dan. Actually, I'll take two more, Ben, and then.
It was just the clarification really as to why you chose Shakespeare. Just at the end, you sort of mentioned you used it more heuristically, whereas from what I recall, the other thinkers that you put in the book seem to have an explicit, almost instrumental role, or at least the professionals that you included in making territory an object of political rule. So have you looked at Shakespeare just to throw some light on it, or do you see him as actually pioneering and perhaps popularising certain concepts of territory? Just as a little addition, if that is the case, is literary still important in doing that today?
That's good.
A small but massive question.
Yeah, that is. That's good. Okay.
Just one more.
Yeah, I just wanted to thank so much for that. That's brilliant. I just wondered if it sort of, from what you've said, what I got thinking about something, I just wondered if you agreed with it, or probably have written quite a lot on it, I bet. You know, I just wondered if you agreed with it, that you were talking a bit about the staging context of Shakespeare, the performance context of Shakespeare in the present. And I just sort of wanted to like try and situate that within the kind of genealogy that you're talking about. I mean, do you think that like the failure, the unwillingness, the inability maybe to stress the political dimensions of some of the history plays constitutes some kind of like Derridean silence about, you know, in terms of like what you were saying at the very end of your talk about the sense of the Westphalian state and some kind of natural, imminent, immovable border being thought of as very natural. Do you think like the lack of addressing those political aspects of different plays constitutes a silence? Because I mean, all the plays that probably we did in school, Hamlet, where we would look at the personal aspect and the relationship with ghosts, the relationship with dad, the relationship with mum, Romeo and Juliet, you could stress political aspects about that, but we'd never probably be led in that direction.
Okay. That gives me enough to go on. Or are there more?
Could you take another one?
I just want to do all the questions as much justice as I can, so yeah.
I mean, I have a very brief question. And this is something I've been thinking about myself, because I've been reading your work, of course, substantially for my own PhD. And this actually relates to the idea of population, but also European representations of Asia. And it seems to me that reading as well from the content of your upcoming book, On Birth of Territory, you seem to start, I mean, the impression I've got at least, is that you start the establishment of territory through the works of Baldus and Bartholus in the transformation of Roman law in the 13th century. And I was wondering, this is very geographically centralized around Europe, and this is really where the short question comes in. Should we not be looking at territories outside of Europe, and especially in the areas that you look at?
Okay, let me try. Why Shakespeare? Well, partly I like Shakespeare. I'm having fun with this. You know, it started with the King Lear thing, and then I thought, well, maybe I could do something on Coriolanus. And then when I talked about this, somebody said, well, what about Richard II? I said, I've got Richard II in my bag. That might be where I'm going next. And it's just grown, and I think there's something in it, and I think it might allow me to talk about territory to people who won't read the other stuff I've done about territory. It might open these up in a different way, and it might be useful or interesting around those things. I don't think Shakespeare is a thinker of territory in the sense that somebody like Leibniz is a thinker of territory. And I'm not trying to make that kind of claim. I'm saying that I think, just as people have done this with a whole range of other questions on Shakespeare, and this was the thing that slightly surprised me, is I've not yet found somebody who's done it for territory. Everything else on Shakespeare seems to have been done. This one so far at least. I've not discovered the person who's already tried to do this. It seems to me to be a potentially interesting way of opening up these questions, because, you know, and a lot of the questions are picking up on this, is kind of why does this matter now? How does this help us to understand this? How does it help us understand something else? I hope that this will raise questions in a different way that might be generative of thinking about things in possibly a slightly different way. Or just saying what I've been trying to say really for the last 10 years or so. Territory, it's much more complicated than you think it is. And really, I think Shakespeare helps us to understand some of those aspects of why it's complicated around those kinds of things. And I treat it in a slightly different way to the way that I treat, for example, Antigone or Beowulf in the book. I think Beowulf actually is extremely revealing about a certain type of practice at the time for which we have relatively few other written records. Shakespeare's time, we have so much other written stuff that if you were looking at how do they think about territory in that particular historical period, you probably wouldn't look at Shakespeare himself. But one of the things that Shakespeare often allows you to do is to open up questions in a much broader and different way to how people might, if they were reading a historical text. But the kind of idea in this is that this will be, you know, contextualised, and I will situate it all within what's actually going on in the England of his time, the kind of wider frame and context and so on, much of which I didn't do today, but will hopefully be in the written version of it. The staging, I've done very little on staging, and I'm not a theatre historian, and I'm not going to try and become one. I think there's some occasional interesting things that stage versions or film versions can shed on what I'm trying to do, but mine is going to be a very textual reading. That's basically what I do. You know, when geographers say, field work, I'd say, well, sit in a library, keep quiet, do some reading, tell me what you've done when you've done some reading. That's kind of how I work, and that's how I think I'll always work. I've always done that as a textual kind of approach to questions, even though I'm interested and fascinated by different ways that these have been portrayed, partly because some of the ways that people say a line can help you to get a different sense of the registers of what might be, you know, because there's a whole load of choices are made in terms of that kind of thing. The actual staging is probably not going to be a major issue there. The language issue partly explains why it's so Eurocentric, is that part of the kind of method approach to how I do stuff is I trace everything back to the original language to try to work out which words are being used. I mean, I made the point about Machiavelli. If you simply read Machiavelli in English, you'll get a misleading sense, it seems to me, of what Machiavelli is about. Similarly, if you read Plato's Laws or Aristotle's Politics, the word territory appears in nearly all the modern translations. Similarly, if you read Caesar, you'll find the word territory, or find words similar to that in Caesar's account of the war in Rome or the Civil War. Is that actually what they're doing? Is that what they're using as words? How are they describing these kinds of notions? And I said how rare territorium was in classical Latin. It was only when I actually went back to the Latin text I realised just how rare it is in classical Latin. In the canonical writers, there are four instances of the use of the word territorium. It's there once in Cicero, once in Seneca, once in Varro, once in Pliny the Elder. It's not there in any of the historians. All the historians that are writing about Roman history, so Sallust, Livy, Tacitus, they never use the word territorium. It's just not there in their plays. They have a different way of talking about the relation between political power and the lands that are being controlled and fought over and so on. It's not there in Caesar. It's not there in a number of other writers. Thinking about that forces you out of the comfortable, oh, they just ordered territory differently from us, and into the more uncomfortable, maybe they ordered things in a different way. And so that's the kind of thing. And that's why I don't go beyond the Western European tradition for this. It's a very Western project, but that's partly because I think territory is a Western concept that then gets superimposed over other ways of ordering the relation between, let's use these as neutral terms for a moment, place and power. And that there may well be a whole history to be written about how in China or in India or in wherever, there are different ways of thinking about the relation between politics and power and place. And then out of that, or through the influence from outside or through the superimposition, a more similar to a Western model of territory gets imposed over this. But I couldn't write that. I'd love to read it, but I can't write it. And what I hope I've done in this is open up questions and maybe develop some of the approaches that other people might potentially say, that's useful or that's not useful, or you need to supplement it with this, or it doesn't fit here, or you need to take a different approach, or you're missing a key dimension, or whatever it might be. I hope that's... It's a Western history, but it's deliberately Western history because of the and also to make it manageable. I mean, it became a huge book just from what I focused on, and so that was part of the reason why I don't turn to those questions. What am I missing? Mike's whole series of suggestions. The body thing is really interesting. Coriolanus is fascinating on the body, partly because Coriolanus is the victorious war hero of Rome, who has put his body on the line and has defended and has conquered and has done all these things, actually gets overthrown, gets kicked out, gets expelled from the Rome itself, because one of the reasons is he refuses to bare his body to show the wounds that he has received in those things. That this is supposed to be the thing that you do, you sort of pull off and you show, look, these scars here and all this, and I wear these marks of what I've done for Rome. And you show it publicly, and that then people can recognise this in a very kind of physical sense. And he refuses to go through this particular ritual, and this is one of the reasons why he's deemed to be arrogant and not. So there's a kind of a bodily politics there as well as the body politic. And that's one of Shakespeare's plays where there's the most physical imagery, the number of animals that are used as descriptions of particular people and acting in particular kinds of ways. So the wounds, the bodies, the corporeal nature of the state, the exile, that for me is fascinating there, and that might open up ways in which we think about the bodies of political leaders. So, you know, Ronald Reagan, with kind of the whole obsession about his body as the aged president, of the president who had to have whatever it was on his butt removed because it had gone cancerous, because of the president in terms of the president who was shot and the physical injury to the body of the president. So you could, and better people than me, have worked through the kind of the bodies of political leaders as a particular kind of set of issues. The territory or the land as kind of something active is something I am interested in. I mean, you mentioned Macbeth as the kind of the physical, elemental sense of what's actually going on in that. The other one, of course, is King Lear, when Lear is on the heath, and there's the whole sort of elemental forces raging around you. And another sort of side project I have, which a number of geographers are starting to think about, is why does geopolitics effectively become a synonym for global politics, when etymologically geopolitics should be the politics of earth or the politics of land? So what happens if we take earth processes seriously and think through their political implications? So natural disasters and obviously climate change and those kinds of questions, but the tsunami and things. What happens if you take the very physical forces of the earth as something that are important in a political register, rather than geopolitics simply being the scale, the global, to which politics is understood and studied? I think there's something potentially interesting that could be done around those kinds of questions. The outside of territories and perception of people, I'm not sure I have particularly much more to say about that, although I think that's interesting in terms of, you know, how you portray what's outside of the borders and so on. I don't think you need to go as far as Australia to think about Asia in that way. I think in Singapore you have a sense of just over the bridge into to JB, into southern part of Malaysia, that this is a kind of completely different way of ordering things compared to the nicely ordered way that Singapore is in. So it's not always necessarily a straightforward racial or regional thing. It can be a much closer proximity in terms of the external and the other and all of those kinds of things, of which much better people than me have written and thought about those. But thinking about the territorial aspect of that, I think, is interesting in terms of the way that territories, as they emerge, start to actually become to the point where there is a border that separates this from that, rather than those sort of more transitional senses of territory. The old sense of a frontier as a zone, a region where people might live, there might be, if you go back to the Greek sense of the polis, it wasn't that sort of Athens and Sparta and Thebes and whatever were right up next to each other. You had a sort of much more centre and then fizzling out as you went further and further away before you found another centre with its spread of power. And so that there are works looking at things like rural shrines that were maybe claimed by two city-states, where there wasn't a particular spatial control by one in those kinds of areas. As you start to get, as population grows, as political control becomes more organised over greater distances and so on, and these start to come up to meet each other at the border, you change the focus of where political power is concentrated much more often to the border than to the centre. And that changes the dynamic in terms of how populations are understood. Alsace-Lorraine is the obvious region within Europe in terms of, are these people German or are they French? They don't really speak the right language for where they are geographically, and this creates a whole range of complexities and so on. But that's partly a product of the emergent states and the emergent sets of political power. So there's the quip that one of Louis XIV's courtiers said to him, well, we've made France, we now need to make French. And part of that was a language project. It was taking the different languages that were spoken in French in France and actually making that people could understand each other. And so you can have language and culture and all of the sort of nationalistic tactics and so on that are used to try to even out some of those anomalies about that. Those kinds of questions, I think, taking territory as the approach maybe opens up a way of thinking about those questions differently.
That's it. I think that's perfect timing. So let's give a really big thank you to Stuart.